You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Ooh, and we're here for Dear Science today with Professor Alan Blackman. As I mentioned, it's a fun time to be sciencing.
Well, I was just thinking, so we're getting rid of the Broadcasting Standards Authority, so I can swear like a trooper now, huh?
Not just yet. I mean, technically you could have sworn already because we're outside of the covered hours. You can't swear when there's going to be like kids in the car driving to and from school.
Oh, really?
But technically we're in the clear right now. That being said...
No, here we go.
That being said, it's science time.
It is.
And we're starting off talking about sports, right?
Yes, yes.
In high intensity moments, I mean, we've all been there, right? The stress gets to you and you might do as the article says and choke.
Yep.
What's going on?
Well, this is really interesting. Some people get all the really good jobs, like, well, as we will see. But for those of you who are not aware, which will be very few, I'm sure you'll know that the World Cup starts on June the 11th, and when we talk about the World Cup, there is only one World Cup.
Yeah.
It's not the Rugby World Cup.
No.
It's not the Cricket World Cup. It's the World Cup football. Yeah. And so that actually starts in Mexico on June the 11th, but it's actually June the 12th our time, of course.
Right.
And Mexico are going to play South Africa. And then the big game on the 16th of June, and how the heck this is going to go ahead, I have no idea. New Zealand against Iran in Los Angeles.
Wow.
I just can't see how that can possibly happen.
The Iranian football team, I think, has been given permission by Trump to play in the US.
Oh, how magnanimous of him.
I know. I mean, when I say given permission, I think he said, I don't care if they play. Or something to that effect.
Dear,
so,
dear. But anyway, let's concentrate on the football.
Mm.
And so the last time the World Cup was held in the US was 1994. Mm. It wasn't a great one from memory, but the final there was decided on penalties.
Unfortunate.
And the last one in Qatar in 2022 was also decided on penalties.
Yeah, and it's a bit less entertaining.
Well, when it comes, it's nerve wracking.
Yeah,
and that's the purpose of this whole talk. It really is seriously nerve wracking. You know, because it was decided on penalties, that means that some one person has to live their entire life knowing that their kick lost the World Cup, you know. And so you can imagine this is a pretty darn high-pressure situation. Your entire, you know, the entire world probably literally is watching. So how do you get around this? How do you hold your nerve in really, really high-intensity situations like this? So, as I said, some people get the really good job. So there's a guy by the name of Geir Jorde. I may pronounce that incorrectly, I'm not sure, but he is a Norwegian sports psychologist. And what he does is, amongst other things, he studies penalty shootouts.
Right.
That'd be a great job, wouldn't
it? Yeah, it does sound very entertaining.
be really, really interesting. And so what he found, talking of interesting, he found a bunch of interesting trends from his very, very, very in-depth analyses of many penalty kicks over many, many years. Some of them might seem sort of self-evident, but, you know, they need to be shown. They need to be shown that this is actually a fact. So, number one, as the stakes go up, the chances of missing your penalty kick goes up.
Right. That does make sense.
Yeah. So, your average sort of backyard football versus the World Cup final, you know, you don't have as much pressure on you. So, that pretty much makes sense. Players are more likely to score a penalty earlier in the game rather than later.
Because the stakes feel lower.
Yeah, exactly. So when it's potentially less important earlier in the game.
Yeah.
And later on in the game, then obviously, you know, you might be chasing a win or something or chasing a draw or whatever. So there's a bit more stress there as well. The next one, penalties are more likely to be missed towards the end of a tournament.
Totally.
And again, so that's the whole stakes are higher sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You're getting towards the end. Everything starts getting more important. You're getting close to that final victory or defeat or whatever. And so that sort of makes sense as well. And this is an interesting one. So players are more likely to score in a penalty shootout if a goal means victory.
Ah.
So if they're kicking to actually win it, then...
Well, if the stakes are as high as they could be.
Well, but that's the weird thing, isn't it? So they're more likely to score in a shootout if a goal means victory, and they are less likely to score if missing means defeat.
Whoa. Hold on. So they're more likely to score if it means victory.
So if that shot means that they'll win it, they're more likely to do it. If the shot means that they're going to lose it if they miss, then they're more likely to miss it.
Right. So how does that balance out?
It doesn't really, does it? That's weird.
Yeah.
And so he also analysed certain sort of patterns amongst the people who missed kicks. So they're looking very carefully at what they do in the lead up to the time where they're actually taking the kick. And so what they found was that, number one, that people who miss the kick are going to be more likely to turn their back on the goalie after they place the ball. Okay, so you put the ball down and then you turn around and walk back.
Yeah.
So seemingly that's not a good sign.
Not very good.
And then the second one is that the players who miss kicks are more likely to spend less time thinking about it. So they just, as soon as the whistle blows, they're straight into it, bang.
Well, I would have thought deliberating would make it worse.
That's what you would have thought as well. Yeah. I would have thought, but apparently both of those things, so the fact that you turn your back on the goalie, that you take it very quickly, they're both signs of anxiety.
Right.
Which, you know, kind of makes sense.
That does make sense.
So as a result of all of this analysis, and, you know, being obviously a very good sports psychologist, this guy Jourde, he was an advisor to the England football team in 2018 when it was held in Russia. You may remember that one. And prior to that, the English football team was renowned for losing in penalty shootouts.
Yeah.
Okay. And it had got to such a point that they'd lost five in a row. Mm. And so they enrolled this guy, along with other sports psychologists, to see if they could help. And in the first knockout game in Russia, they won. This was their first win. And since that time, they won 2 out of 3 since. So they seem to have, you know, done something right. But, you know, basically his advice is deep breaths and positive thinking.
Yeah.
Go a long way.
There really is a science to it.
Oh, absolutely there is. So I thought that was kind of cool. Very, very interesting stuff. Yeah. So,
And then this next one, beer. Right?
Beer.
We know it tastes good.
Football and beer, my goodness. We're talking about the good things today, aren't we?
Yeah. Why? Why does beer taste good is the question we're seeking to answer right now. Bad?
Not so much why, but what? Let's say. What makes it taste good?
Right.
Okay, so we're talking specifics here. We're talking specific individual things in the beer. So, you know, beer drinkers out there, you all know what you like and what you don't like. Mm. I don't like things infused with hops to a point that where you can't bloody drink
the stuff. I'm not a big fan of extremely hoppy beers.
No, this IPA craze. No.
I'm sorry.
Let's get back to good old lagers and stuff like that. You could actually sort of drink without having to screw up your face. Oh,
now this
goodness.
Is sounding like a football and beer.
So beer is made up of literally hundreds of compounds, literally, okay? And so therefore the question is, why do, you know, what? Which ones of those make it taste good?
Right.
Can we actually even do that? Can we take it down to a certain number of compounds that actually do influence the flavor in a good way or indeed in a bad way? And so there was a bunch of workers at Ohio State University in the States, and they thought, let's have a look at this.
So check it out.
What they did, they bought 18 lagers. Now, remembering that these are American lagers, probably shouldn't say that, but, you know, Budweiser and, you know, not much flavour there.
Yeah. I think it's fairly agreed upon.
No. America does have good beer. They've got a whole lot of microbreweries and stuff like that. So,
The big name lagers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they bought 18 lagers. They got 134 beer drinkers in to taste them and basically rate them. So, you know, which ones do you like best? Which ones don't you like, obviously? And so once they had these rankings, then what they did was they analysed the beer. And they analysed two things about the beer. They analysed the volatiles, okay? So these are the molecules that can get up into the air above the beer, and they give that beer the aroma, which is thought to be important. You know, it's not just taste, it's also aroma. It gives it that smell. And so they analysed the headspace above the beer with a thing called GCMS, gas chromatography mass spectrometry, and that allows you to basically pick out those volatiles, shoot them through a machine. The machine tells you what they are, basically.
Awesome.
And then they would take the liquid phase of the beer as well, and they'd do the same thing, except they would use an LCMS, which is liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, same principles, etc., and basically shoot it through the machine, and the machine magic, and it tells you what it is. And so the volatiles give you the aroma, the what's in the liquid gives you sort of the mouth feel and the taste, okay? And what they found amongst everybody was that the aroma actually wasn't the most important thing. The most important thing appeared to be the taste and the mouth feel.
Right.
And that comes from the molecules that remain in the liquid, not the stuff that is in the headspace. And what they found, so through an analysis of all of this, they found four compounds that appeared to be in the liquid phase in all of the in many of the beers that people didn't like.
Oh.
Which is kind of interesting.
We've got the bad stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And so these all have very long names. We're not going to worry about them, but they are just they're just molecules, okay?
Yeah.
And here's the really weird thing. So they sort of narrowed it down to these four. And so what they did, they would take tiny amounts of these four and they'd put them in water and give the people their water to drink.
Yeah.
And they couldn't taste them.
Ah.
Couldn't taste them. But when they took the beer that everybody liked and they put the same amount of these four molecules in the beer.
Instant difference?
Instant difference.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's the molecule that makes beer taste bad.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't taste the water makes bad. Yeah. So you know, obviously it must be interacting with other molecules in the beer or something and forming something that they said it made it taste bitter and sharper.
Ah.
Okay. So which is absolutely fascinating, I reckon. And so the actual molecules, these four molecules that they've sort of narrowed it down to, seem to be related to actual molecules in the wild that defend plants against insects.
Right.
So, you know, there's a nice little link there, I guess.
Yeah, and you'd expect them not to be the tastiest of stuff.
So therefore, if you can isolate those things, take them out of your beer, it's going to taste better. As simple as that. There you go.
And last of all, we've got a happy birthday to Dorothy Hodgkin, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry.
She did indeed. And my bet would be that not many of the listeners would be familiar with her.
No, not me. I haven't a clue. I read that out sounding like I knew exactly who she was. No, I've done my research beforehand.
Okay.
But before today, I had no clue.
Okay. So it's her birthday today, and she would have been, 126, I guess. No, 116, sorry, 116. So as you can probably imagine, she's no longer with us. But she was an amazing chemist, and she was only the third female to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry. She won that in 1964. And what she got it for was determining the structure of a particular molecule. You've all have heard of vitamin B12.
Wow. That's okay. One of the big ones.
That is one of the big ones. Literally. It's quite a big molecule. And the way that she did it was a thing called X-ray crystallography.
Sounds fun.
It is. So crystallography, it sort of lies in the name, what you need to do is get crystals of your material. And so you luckily can crystallize vitamin B12. You then shoot X-rays at it.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And these X-rays, when they hit the crystal, they essentially get bounced off in different directions.
Right.
Let's say that's a very, very simple view of what's going on. But they bounce off in different directions. And in her day, what would happen would they would have a photographic plate. And every time an X-ray hit the photographic plate, it would leave a spot.
Yeah.
And it would leave a spot of a particular intensity and in a particular position.
So you'd be able to measure sort of the shape and the layout. And
That's basically it.
Wow.
That's basically the way that it works. And in an ideal world, we would be able to focus the X-rays and get a nice little picture of what this is. But, but we can't focus X-rays. We can't do that. So therefore, we have to do some serious, serious maths.
Right.
In order to back calculate what your actual molecule looks like from where these spots are in space, their intensities and their positions and everything. And it's just a massive, massive job. And she was an absolute pioneer in this particular field of chemistry. And so she was, again, as I say, quite rightly in 1964, she won the Nobel Prize for determining the structure of vitamin B12. And then 5 years later, 1969, she deduced what the structure of insulin is.
Wow.
Now, there's a
That seems like an even more important one.
That's a very, very, very important molecule. Yeah. And it's way, 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 way bigger than vitamin B12. It's quite a large molecule, 35 or something, or 40 amino acids all joined together. That took her 35 years. 35 years to do that. And nowadays, dare I say it, we could do it in a day easily.
Wow.
Easily.
So our technology's advanced that far.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yes. And Auckland University actually have an X-ray diffractometer, which is top of the range, worth $1 million. They do wonderful stuff on it. I use it a bit. it's absolutely brilliant. But so happy birthday, Dorothy Hodgkin. Now, she spent her academic life at Oxford.
Hmm.
And in the 1940s in Oxford, she taught one Margaret Hilda Baker. Who is better known as? Margaret Hilda Roberts. Sorry, goodness.
Margaret Hilda Roberts. Who's Margaret Hilda Roberts?
Well, her married last name was Thatcher.
Oh, well, that's not ideal. That's not, we shouldn't be happy about that.
And apparently, Mrs. Thatcher, as she was known, kept a picture.
As she was known. I can think of a few more things she was known as.
But she kept a picture of her scientific mentor, Dorothy Hodgkin, in her office when she became Prime Minister.
That's very nice.
So, Margaret Thatcher was a chemist. There you go. So was Elena Ceaușescu. Not really good.
Not some very inspiring chemist.
No, sadly not. But ironically, Hodgkin was very, very left-wing. And her mentor was a devoted communist.
Wow.
Way back in the sort of 30s and 40s and everything, when it wasn't the right time to be that. As a result of that, she got refused entry into the US in 1953 because of her political leanings, shall we say.
That's unfortunate.
So, yeah, kind of similar to today, isn't it? Just a little.
Very accomplished.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for sharing all of these lovely scientific stories with us, Alan. And thank you to Moshat, as always. And thank you, science. Find out what the future of fitness looks like at Sports Tech, 23rd and 24th of May, a whole weekend of fun activities focused on the innovative world of sports technology. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.